Lay down your microphones, all ye podcasters. Fair ladies, don your funeral garb. For Aaron Prince Tappe, that stalwart old oak tree, has fallen and no longer spreads his gnarled boughs over the grieving forest floor. And by gnarled boughs, I mean good vibes. And by forest floor, I mean the Greater London metropolitan area. In life, he was a based man. Of letters, he had many. Of paramours, he had still more. And of equals, he had few. For all over the world, Fulham to Istanbul, Boston to Inverleith, no one thought the old oak tree could ever be felled, nor that any scoundrel would ever dare cross swords with the fearless hero, with the hallowed dream weaver, the silver-tongued didact. And yet, that venerable old tree stands no more, and silence echoes in the deep-shaded woods where boundless Riz once rang forth. They have taken Aaron from this earth, and with him all of our joy. And why? Because his heart was too big, his bitch was too bad, and he spoke more different than anyone else. And so they had to kill him.
Sorry, what? I heard some poetry going.
Oh, sorry, don't what? Just putting some
what
stuff.
What does that say?
What? This? No, this is nothing.
Have you been telling people I'm dead?
This is just my fan fiction.
Fan fiction about me being a dead tree?
Possibly. It's a metaphor.
Why are you telling people I'm dead?
It's a metaphor.
Are you trying to write me out of the show?
I'm not trying to...
Oh my god, I knew it! I knew it!
You know
You're
what?
You're jealous of me.
I just think that, you know, in a... When two bards of such skill cross paths, two people with such, you know, great craft, I just think there can really only be one.
All right, so a bard off. That's what it's going to be, is it right? I'm going to go get my loot. Let's get to it.
Yeah, you know what? Why not? You bring your best game, I'll bring mine. Winner takes it all. Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a bard I employ to write silly little poems for me.
That is basically what it felt like to get recruited into doing this podcast. So you need somebody to talk at you.
Yeah, definitely.
To make the show happen.
Yep, you're a real scrivener. If you're wondering what you just heard, that was my homage to medieval Welsh elegiac poetry, in which Welsh poets would write elegies for each other, not after they died, but while both of them were still alive.
Stop telling people I'm dead!
Just to have a bit of fun.
Well, you know, you never get to hear your own eulogy. You never get to hear all the nice things about you until after you're dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we should bring it back.
No, they're absolutely stunning poems. I mean, I was reading this one that was written by one of Dafydd Ap Gwilym's contemporaries. It's called For the Yew Tree Above Dafydd's Grave. Yew tree for the best lad, near the wall of Ystrad Fleur and its mansion. Good was God to you, bliss of trees, to grow you as a house for Dafydd. Holy Dafydd prophesied of you, before you were grown against sadness. After your growing, Dafydd fashioned you, because of his youth was it, to dedicate you as a house of green leaves, a house and every grove bearing leaves, a hidden castle of the dead against snow wind, as good as the branching tree before.
Very good, very arty. There's going to be a lot of that in this.
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting poem because it starts off with this pretty gripping, very, like, emotionally intense, I would say, stanza. But then the last stanza starts, no flock of goats shall foul you. Do not waste away. Your growth is in your father's land.
Goats will not shit on you.
Yep, exactly. And then he goes on to list all the different ways that harm might come to this tree. He says, fire shall not burn you, nor carpenter cut you, nor love wound you, nor shoemaker strip you, etc.
Be ashamed if something happened to you.
Exactly. And this was written for Dabith while he was still alive. And it's, you know, I would say one of many things about medieval Welsh and in general Welsh poetic tradition that's very unique and worth exploring. And that's what we're going to be doing in today's episode.
Yeah, so I think we've been thinking about doing this episode, to be honest, for a while, because I think we're both very, very fascinated by medieval Welsh culture. It's one of the most unique cultures in medieval Latin Europe. It's very different from the cultures that surround it, like England and Scotland. And one of the reasons why it is so different is because you have this huge canon of not just very vivid poetry, but very importantly, poetry that's written in the vernacular. So written in Welsh rather than in Latin or in French, because of course in most medieval Latin Christian countries, it was only right and proper that high culture, well, it should be in Latin, but if you can't stretch to Latin, you should at least do French. But whereas in Wales, the Welsh language is really upheld even by the elite as something that is worthy of being used for high culture. And so what we're going to do in this episode is we are going to talk about one very specific kind of person in medieval Wales, which is the archetype of the bard, and talk about how they were able to kind of shape this really unique cultural space and create poetry that is epic and violent and heart-stoppingly beautiful and incredibly horny. It really has, I mean, it really has, I think, for me at least, what sets medieval Welsh culture apart, and I don't know if this is a product of it, not of it being written in the vernacular rather than Latin, it really does feel much less stuffy, even though it is formulaic in its own way. It feels almost closer to modern culture in a strange sort of way. And we're going to talk about why.
Yes.
So I think, first of all, though, before we get to poetry, I think we're going to have to take a step back and just sort of explain to people what Wales is. Because most people outside of the UK probably only experience Wales in the context of sport. I mean, as we're recording this, the Six Nations is going on in the rugby. Wales is not doing very well. But, you know, usually if you live outside the UK, you only hear about Wales in its rugby, or if they've made it into one of the football competitions, because, of course, Wales has its own national football team, or the TV show Welcome to Wrexham.
Yeah.
Which I think, where amazingly they do at the start, like the very, very, very basic introduction to what is a Wales when it's at home. So we're going to do that very quickly. Any Welsh listeners, and I know we have some, this is all going to feel a bit GCSE, but just bear with us. We have to give some context to the people. I think any good discussion of Wales and Welsh history has to start with your favorite thing,
which is etymologies. Yes.
Because Wales has two names, and both of them are incredibly instructive about Welsh history and Welsh identity. So we've been referring to Wales by its English name, but Wales also has a Welsh name, which is Cymru.
Yes, and so this is a native Welsh name. It comes from a Celtic origin, and it basically means roughly fellow countrymen in Welsh, and the word for Wales and the word for the Welsh people, so the word for the land and the population, they're spelt slightly differently, but they're both pronounced Cymru. Now, on the other hand, you're probably not used to using that word if you live outside of Wales. You just call it Wales, most likely. And so Wales is a name that actually is Germanic in origin. It originates from outside the United Kingdom. And it's a word that essentially, the root word that it came from, which I won't try to pronounce because pronunciation guides for reconstructed languages scare me. But it's a word that essentially translates to foreigner and was applied broadly to anyone living under Roman rule, but in particular has survived as a name for Wales.
Yeah, I should say that you can see that root word in a lot of regions that speak Romance languages. So the French-speaking region of Belgium is Wallonia. Romanians were originally called Vlachs, which was the origin of the name of Wallachia, which was the kingdom of many people, but most notably Dracula.
And even Cornwall, in fact, derives from the same root word. Not sure if you knew that.
Yes, I actually did know that.
And the same root, interestingly enough, also survives in the word walnut, which basically just means foreign nut.
That's what I call you.
And in German as well, they have a word. The word is Welsch, which comes from the same root as well, and also just means strange or foreign. So we have quite a dichotomy within Wales. The country is a country of fellows, and outside of Wales, although of course this isn't what people think of nowadays when they say the name Wales, it's a country of foreigners, of strangers.
Yeah, so to understand why Wales got basically saddled with a name that means Latin-speaking foreigners, when A, if you're Welsh and you live in Wales, you're not a foreigner, and B, they don't speak Latin, we have to go all the way back to the Roman Empire. So history time, story time. When the Romans arrived in Britain, the island of Britain, they found this constellation of tribes living all across the island who spoke variations on the same sort of root language. I'm just going to call it Brittonic for ease of reference. And the Romans, they come along and they conquer like the southern two-thirds of the island of Britain. They don't get up to Scotland, famously, but they do conquer pretty much all of the territory of modern-day England and Wales. And so the Britons, as we'll call them, these Brittonic-speaking people suddenly find themselves under the dominion of Rome. And so, you know, they got to start learning Latin to interact with their new Roman overlords. And whilst there are various sort of risings, for the most part, Britannia just sort of chugs along as a Roman province until the 5th century, when the legions depart to deal with problems closer to home, and the Britons are left sort of bewildered as to what to do. The Romans, the structure that they leave behind devolves into this sort of patchwork of petty kingdoms, all of which are feuding with each other. And to make matters worse, there are raiders coming down from the north, the Picts and the Scots, coming from Ireland, confusingly. But we do not have time to get into that. So the Britons decide they need defenders. And who do they call up to help them fight off the Picts and Scots?
I don't know.
It's our old pals, the Anglo-Saxons.
Oh, yes.
So that goes pretty horribly wrong. Because the Anglo-Saxons, which is a sort of broad term for these tribes from Northern Europe, you know, modern-day Germany, Netherlands, Denmark, that sort of place. That sort of...
Germanic-speaking people.
Germanic-speaking people. They get there and they decide, actually, this is all right. This is... Would it be so terrible if we came along and took over the show? And so they basically do that over the next century. And the one by one, the Brittonic kingdoms are defeated by the Anglo-Saxons. And gradually, the Britons get pushed further and further west until essentially the only parts of formerly Roman Britain that haven't been conquered by the Anglo-Saxons are in this peninsula on the west coast that is the territory of modern-day Wales.
I think they should have some kind of, like, exclusive membership club for countries that have never been conquered or colonized. Like, get Ethiopia, Scotland, Nepal in there. There's probably some more.
Well, Wales is sadly not make it to that club, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Go on.
Unfortunately, this is not the end of the story.
Yeah.
So Wales suddenly finds the territory that we now call Wales suddenly finds itself as this kind of amputated remnant of the formerly, you know, island-spanning British community, whereas the, you know, the Britons in England are being sort of gradually assimilated into Anglo-Saxon culture.
Yeah, so it's hard to say exactly when what's thought of as the Anglo-Saxon conquest ended, because over time the understanding of the whole situation has shifted a little bit away from this idea of the Anglo-Saxons as a unified group that came in, you know, specific, that came at a specific time and place, and more of a general trend and a cultural shift that, of course, did nevertheless involve a fair bit of violence and coercion.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, at least to get to the heart of it, by the 9th or 10th century, Britain has become pretty Germanified. Old English is the lingua franca, so to speak, across most of it.
If you're wondering what's happening up in Scotland, something completely different we don't have time to get into.
We'll do Scotland later.
We'll do Scotland eventually, yeah. But anyway, so yeah, by the 9th century, really, you do have this pretty clear divide between, in the territory of what's now Wales, you have these this handful of kingdoms, which we will now just call the Welsh kingdoms from here on out to stop things getting confusing, which are still, you know, Britonic speaking, or as they'll come to be known, Welsh speaking, and in the east you have the sort of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. Now, over the course of like the 9th century onwards, those Anglo-Saxon kingdoms will congeal into the Kingdom of England. What's very important about Wales is that in Wales, the Britonic kingdoms don't. They stay basically this sort of handful of petty kingdoms that are occasionally united by a prince, which is where we get the term Prince of Wales, who is sort of basically just a temporary overlord rather than a stable stable system of government. And that office, I should say, is usually held by the kings of Gwynedd, which is the kingdom in the northwest, where sort of a lot of the most important cultural developments happen in Wales. So you might think, okay, so for the Welsh, they've had a rough time of it in the early Middle Ages, but surely that's the end of the problems, right? Well, not quite, because in the 11th century, the Norman conquest of England happens, and this obviously has huge consequences for England, but it has knock-on consequences for the Welsh kingdoms as well, because William the Conqueror, once he has finished conquering England, he gives basically license to these Norman lords to go in and set up their own little sort of quasi-independent lordships that are under his dominion in the south of Wales, which are called the Marcher Lordships. And so another chunk of Wales now, another chunk of the formerly Britonic territory, is being absorbed once again into the English sphere of influence, you could say. But we're not done yet, because it continues to get worse. Whilst, you know, Wales does... So while England has congealed into what we would now recognize as the Kingdom of England, and the same process, by the way, is happening in Scotland at more or less the same time, Wales is slowly coming into consciousness as its own state. The princes of Wales are becoming more formalized, more recognized, more powerful over their territory. The prince Hywel-Dda creates this law code, the laws of Hywel-Dda, which sort of apply across all of Wales. You can sort of see the skeleton of a Welsh state coming into existence. Until it gets worse again. So in the 1280s, Edward I, who is better known for his work in Scotland, we shall say, as the Hammer of the Scots and the guy who killed William Wallace, he subjugates Wales, brings it under his own dominion, and names his heir as the Prince of Wales. And that is the reason that the heir to the British throne to this day is known as the Prince of Wales when they assume that title. Because that goes all the way back to Edward I. legendary supervillain of the 13th century, in my opinion. So that's it then, it seems. Wales is technically independent, but under English dominion. Except there's one final stand. One final, like, meaningful act of resistance, which is in 1400, a man called Owain Glyndŵr, who is of noble lineage, one of the old royal lines of Wales, who I'm sure we'll get into again later. He's basically this kind of polymath. You know, he's a lawyer, he's a soldier, he's kind of the perfect Renaissance king. He basically, on a whim, decides that he is going to set up a Principality of Wales. And he does succeed for about 15 years and gets recognized as the ruler of an independent Wales, I should say, by the kings of Scotland and England, which is not nothing, until his rebellion is put down again. And he sort of disappears mysteriously off into the hills. Nobody knows when he dies. It's a real sort of Arthur in the cave situation. And that pretty much brings us to the end of the Middle Ages. Although I will say that the Tudor dynasty of Henry VIII fame did come from Wales originally, so Wales gets the last laugh, as far as I'm concerned.
To the extent that having Henry VIII, one of your ambassadors, should be a point of pride, then yeah.
History's greatest Welshman.
Exactly.
An insane, horny English king.
Yep.
So that was a whole lot about Wales, not a lot about bards or poetry.
Yeah, I want to hear about the bards.
Okay, let's get bardic. Let's bard it up.
Yeah.
So, before we get to the actual poetry itself, I think we need to answer, what was the job of a bard in medieval Wales?
We touched on jesters before, and the question of, like, is a jester really just a funny little guy that you keep on retainer and pay to have around for the cultural value that he provides? And in the same vein, a bard could certainly be described in this way. It's essentially, you know, much in the same way that you might have a cook or a cleaner employed in your noble household, you might also choose to have a bard.
So yeah, so the job of a bard was actually tightly regulated by Welsh law, and we get brilliant descriptions of what the different levels of bard are in a royal household. So the king would have a bard called the Chief of Song, who would win that title in a poetry competition. So like basically the world's greatest open mic.
Yes, rap battle.
Yes, exactly. And then hold that position for life. And he was basically required to perform oral poetry about God and about the king at sort of basically any grand occasion. And then you would also have, sitting next to him, you'd have the family poet, who was basically a sort of permanent member of the family household, whereas the Chief of Song is more of a sort of cabinet level position. And by the way, this guy, the family poet, he would have... He would get his clothing, he would get his land for free, he'd be able to keep a horse for free, and the queen would have to provide him with linen clothing, and the king would have to provide him with wool clothing. It's a pretty good setup.
They were all about, like, meaningfully symbolic divisions of labor among the genders, weren't they, the Welsh?
Yep. he was also, one of the things that he was required to do was to sing a song called The Monarchy of Britain, which is like the sort of medieval Welsh national anthem, at a great feast after every great battle, and in exchange they would give him a free ox and some of the loot.
Amazing.
But of course, I think another thing to note that's really important about bards is that they aren't just poets or minstrels. They also have a really important political role, because before really like the 9th, 10th century, Welsh law was not necessarily always codified, and it was the job of the bard to be a sort of living receptacle of all this knowledge, because he has to memorize all these poems. Why shouldn't he also memorize all this legal text? And by the way, if you want to know more about like how that affected governance and how that affected how law worked, we have an extended segment in our divorce episode all about medieval Welsh divorce law, which is very fun, and I recommend everybody check it out. It's basically turns law into like a burlesque show. But yeah, so the bard is, and I warned Olivia they were going to be, I was going to be making Dune comparisons.
Oh boy.
In this episode. So if anybody who's seen or read Dune.
Which one of us is editing this one?
It's you. I'm on holiday.
Okay.
No, it's my comparisons are going to be so good. You're not going to do it.
Go on.
So in Dune, you can drink a thing called the Water of Life, which sort of, which gives you access to all of your kind of ancestral memories, stretching back through your sort of, stretching back all the way through your lineage. And you become, you sort of become depersonalized by that experience and become this kind of receptacle for all of this ancient history, but also all of the sort of, all of the machinations of the sort of political figures that you're descended from. And that, I think, that synthesizes what the role of a bard actually is, which is to be this living embodiment of dynastic power, both through the power of storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've talked before about the importance, not just in the Middle Ages, but in human culture and European culture in general, of establishing lines of pedigree and lines of inheritance, because the idea is often that if you can say, this is, you know, my family has been doing this since forever, that establishes your right to continue doing something, usually holding power. And so the bardic tradition was a really important part of this in medieval Wales. However, it was, especially early on, largely an oral tradition.
Yeah, because one of the interesting things about medieval Welsh poetry is that a lot of the poetry that we have on record is appears to be much older than the manuscripts that they are written down in, and that's because this was meant to this stuff was meant to be memorized and recited and performed orally, like it was a theatrical performance. And this, I think, is one of the things that it's really important to explain before we get into the actual content. Is that when we read medieval poetry, we are left with this dead letter, because all we have is what's written down, and it's because it's not a living tradition. There's no continuous tradition of medieval poetry that's unbroken for the last 1,000 years. We kind of have to imagine ourselves into what that poetry felt like, down to basic things like, you know, what cadence was used to deliver it? Like, what was the role of the audience? And did the audience interact with the performer? We just don't really know for sure.
Yeah, and this is something I wanted to touch on briefly as well, because even though the term like folk art and folk tradition is a pretty nebulously defined one, I think we can categorize Welsh bardic oral tradition in that, at least with some degree of confidence. And one thing that I notice a lot when I'm watching or engaging with folk arts, like even folk dancing and folk music and things like this, is that the way that we consume this type of thing in the modern day is often very, very far removed from how it was meant to be consumed when these traditions were established. Like, I remember watching some, I think they were Latvian dancers at a festival in Manchester last year. And I thought the whole, you know, the dancing was amazing. I mean, the dancing was good, but like...
Rapid retreat from that position.
Actually, no, I won't hit out at the Latvians. But like, for instance,
big
you know,
up when, the Latvians.
When you watch, for instance, like English folk dancing, English country dancing, things like that, it can often look a little bit, you know, stilted and a little bit dull. But a lot of these art forms were created not necessarily to be watched, but to be engaged with. And whether that's because you're out there dancing or singing as well, or maybe you're jeering in the audience and clapping and screaming and shouting, but a lot of what we could describe as folk arts were made so that you could get together with a bunch of your mates and, like, you know, basically all just have fun, you know, reading stories or playing music. And in particular, reading stories and playing music that reflects the values of your culture and your shared values. And, that way you're not only having fun, but you're also kind of affirming this is our culture, this is our, these are our traditions. We all belong together doing this. And so I think that's an important part of folk arts that often gets missed out.
Well, yeah, which is why, well, there's, I think there's an exception to that. And this is, we are now veering heavily away from Wales, but I think it's, I think it's a useful comparison point. The one bit of folk arts that I think does sustain, the one example of folk art that I can think of does sustain that tradition is the Scottish Ceilidh.
I knew you were going to say, I was thinking about that while I was saying it. Which
is boozy and everybody takes it not seriously at all. It's just an opportunity to get together. And the reason, what makes it such an amazing binding agent is the fact that everybody knows the dances. And so everybody can just lock in and basically play along. That's why Ceilidh is the best thing about being Scottish. It's incredible.
Yes.
It's so much fun.
And in the same vein, medieval Welsh poetry and the bardic tradition also had, you know, a set of rules that you were meant to engage with. It has its own meters and rhyme schemes and ways for arranging syllables and stress that you're supposed to follow. But it was also very much a form of art for people to used to engage with each other. I mean, they had, beginning, I think, in the 12th or 11th centuries, they had literary festivals and bard festivals.
Oh, yeah.
They had BardCon. I mean, the same way, or maybe a more apt description would be that, you know, in the same way that when they play the US Open in tennis, you have all of the big names together in one place, and it's like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Who's going to be pitted against who? This was that, but for all of the big names of Welsh poetry.
So that's how you should imagine poetry being engaged with. But let's talk about some actual examples of poetic forms, because we've kind of referenced that the bard's role is very, very, very political. And so I think it's natural to start with, I think, probably the most politicized kind of poem that you get in medieval Wales, which is praise poetry. Now, praise poetry, this is something that's common across Celtic, and I use that term advisedly, Celtic cultures, going all the way back to the classical period. Like Julius Caesar writes about it, Posidonius writes about it. And this is basically where a poet will, sometimes on the fly, on demand, compose a poem in praise of their patron, so a lord or a king. And it will usually have very sort of clear structure. So you have to talk about how he's a great warrior, how he's so generous to the people, how great his hall is, and how and no, this is super
freely
important.
Freely the ale flows.
No, absolutely.
No, I know.
Like he can, like one of the signs of a good king in medieval Wales is he knows how to throw a fucking party.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, at least until those stinky Normans showed up across all of Northern Europe. A lot of culture was based on having specifically a really long house and getting all your guys together and arranging them in order of how much you like them and then throwing a big party.
I gotta make sure my house is extra long so I can fit all my friends in a line.
Exactly.
So it's not just nobility who got praise poetry. Anyone could have praise poetry written about them. And like when you were trained as a bard at a bardic college, you would get taught like the kinds of things you would need to say about people based on their profession. So we have surviving grammar books from bardic colleges that say like, so for example, what do you think what are the right things to say about teachers?
Teachers, I guess, probably that they're well-educated. That seems like a good prerequisite.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so teachers shall be praised for wisdom and eloquence, for the excellence of their rules and regulations, for the depth of genius of the arts, for victory in disputation, for gentleness and good looks, and for distinguished ancestry, for liberality and good manners, for amiability and for other praiseworthy things. So for any history teachers listening, if you want a fun exercise with your class that's also going to boost your ego, yes, get them to write praise poetry, medieval Welsh praise poetry about you. So that always sounds very formulaic. But in actual fact, a lot of the poems can be really evocative and beautiful because they use imagery in really interesting ways. So there's a, I'll read a little bit of this poem to a warrior. So it says, "Swifter than a tempest over a red sky, the tumult of a mighty whirlwind sweeping the ocean, the crash of a wave breaking upon the shore about the feet of seagulls, a roar of torrents falling into the full sea, the rush of uncontrollable fire sweeping through dry underbrush." Now, that doesn't actually tell us anything about the subject, but it paints an image. It's about, like, it's not, he's not saying, like, he's a great warrior because he killed all those people. It's because he's an avatar of these, he's a force of nature, literally.
Yeah.
And I think that the existence of praise poetry as a sort of form and as a thing that people would recognize explains why you would write a eulogy about somebody before they died.
Yeah, exactly. Just like the one that was written by David F. Gwilym's contemporary. And it's well documented that these two poets were friends and also rivals. And also that just like, you know, in the same vein as these poetry conventions and gatherings they had, that it was a highly competitive atmosphere. It was a fun way to engage with one of your peers, praising them, but maybe sticking in some sort of sideways remarks about, or some underhanded remarks about how you sure hope no goats start, you know, crapping on his grave once he's gone. And for that reason, actually, a lot of the elegiac poems we have for medieval Wales, we don't know whether they were written before or after the subject died.
Mm. Actually, you bring up the fact that somebody can use a poem to have a dig at you. It's really important to note that, like, if a bard didn't like a king or lord, he absolutely could write a brutally scathing satire of that lord, basically saying, your house is crap, your parties suck, you're an absolute Scrooge with the people, by the way, and you're a coward. And that would be devastating. It's like getting destroyed in a rap battle. You just have to leave.
Yeah, well, it's like every time, you know, Elon Musk goes on Twitter and someone says something so mean to him that he has to, like, you know,
block them.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you can't block a bard because they are given pretty much free license to roam around, be itinerant, and say whatever they want. And so, and that is that honesty, I think, and that ability to be honest is why they're such an effective way of legitimizing rule. Because if, basically, I mean, the praise poetry is a kind of propaganda in a pre-literate society where, you know, political legitimacy is a story that we choose to tell ourselves. And we can change the story that we tell just based on if we collectively decide to. And so the idea that poetry would be a way of reinforcing your own political position is just such a wonderfully kind of evocative representation of what is otherwise quite a dry political science concept.
Yeah. In the same vein, a lot of these restrictions on what kinds of verse and meter you're supposed to use might, you know, I was reading through them earlier and some of them, to be honest, are like a bit eye-watering, but it's also part of the tradition that once you have these established forms of poetry that have very specific intended purposes, and I will come back to this later as well, that then you can take it and have a little bit of fun with it as well and introduce some irony by maybe writing a poem about something, you know, for which that form wasn't originally intended, or by using it as a mechanism for humor.
It's satire or parody or almost like kind of sampling the beat of a song to remix it into your own song in a kind of way.
Definitely. So, for instance, in particular, the poets David F. Gwilym and Griffith Grug, to name a couple, engaged in a very hearty and fierce back and forth in verse, basically just taking pot shots at each other.
And again, you should imagine these being performed orally.
And every time someone delivers a particularly scathing line, there's a bunch of guys going, oh! And then the other guy has to get up there and, you know.
I mean, it is trite to say it, but this is a medieval rap battle, basically. Because again, these would have musical accompaniment. People would be doing it in sort of in rhyme and meter. So just imagine that's what we're doing right now.
Yes. Okay. So just start at the first line. So we're going to have a bit of a back and forth in that style.
Ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere in the world tonight, but you're here with us in Arfon for a poetry reading. Woo! First up, Griffith Groog.
I love you, Griffith.
And introducing Davith Ap Gwilym.
Oh my God, Davith, I want to marry you.
A wonder for sad Davith, son of Gwilym Gam, blameless man, a very bald fellow, sorrow's bedmate, spears have paralyzed him 100 times. The ill-bred fellow is also fostering song, faint and in bondage, prolonged weak occupation in his cry. By the mother of God, he says there's a pitiful agony upon a Welshman. Amazing that he's alive.
If he wants poetry, golden, gentle hammer blow, let him go to the woods to cut matter. Not very skillful, aptly nicknamed, is the praise poet of remarkable renown, who needs a vain thread for the material of his hollow poem, with his hand on a well-finished handrail. The old fawn, he runs slowly. Let the poet sing to the other good-looking girl, a poem made out of his own old wood. I am backwards, a warning to the very foolish Griffith. The darling of every fair, a strong one, will obstruct him. Boasting stammering book, the echo stone of poets. Let the son of stuttering pay a portion of his work to me.
Oh! He's wild. I don't know whether it's better for me to see Davith Ap Gwilym with his grimly deceiving hand of illicit gain. Handsome Davith is like Gwendolyn. Good in my presence, a ready shoulder, and bad in my absence. And reckless. Davith have told the men of the south in his false poem there was nothing of mine in my poetry except for his teaching. He was the bardic master. He told a lie by Dewey. And let me be tested whenever it's desired. He swore that I do with my tongue. Nothing but distort poetry. Simple is his course. His accusations are numerous. Davith is fond of his own voice. Every immodest bird in the cozy birches is fond of how lovely his voice is.
Griffith Groog, readying scorn. Grouse of the lying crude song. Shame on your beard in Arfon, and upon your lip shame in Mon. I'm wise. God has been good to you. While spinning in my throat, protecting you, escaping strangely from the wandering poets. Are you fat, unprofitable food for lice, very persistent enemy of poets? Rule your reckless pride with ready, brilliant, impudent intention. Bridle, end your deception. Ask for refuge. You were perverse. Restrain your boasting, dark bastard.
Oh! Damn! So, there is another genre of poetry that you have to be au fait with if you're a Welsh poet, and that is historical epic poetry. And I think to introduce this genre, I think I have to stick with probably the most, maybe the most widely known medieval Welsh poem. Certainly, it was one of the poems that you absolutely had to have in your arsenal, ready to go, if you were a Welsh poet. Which was a poem called Y Gododdin, or The Gododdin. Now, this is Actually, this is the oldest historical epic in the entire canon of Western Europe. It was composed, or at least surviving. It was composed sometime around the 6th century by someone called Aneurin. And it depicts a 6th century battle between the Britons of what the Welsh called the Old North, which was essentially Scotland, and the advancing Anglo-Saxons. Basically, the plot of the poem depicts the King of the Gododdin, which is one of the kingdoms of Britain, basically issues a call to assemble the 300 greatest warriors in all of Britain to go down and fight the Anglo-Saxons. And they go down and they face them at a place called Tretraeth, and they are almost entirely massacred. And so the poem is a series of eulogies, actually, to the men who fought in that battle. And so it's a series of 80 stanzas, each describing a part of the battle or somebody who died in it. And I'll just read a couple of short excerpts to give you a sense of it, because it is quite long. The men went to Catraeth. They were renowned. Wine and mead from golden cups was their beverage. The year was to them of exalted solemnity. 300 wearing the golden torques. Of those who hurried forth after the excess of revelling, but 3 escaped by the prowess of the gnashing sword. The 2 war dogs of Aeron and Canaan were dauntless, and myself from the spilling of my blood, the reward of my sacred song. The leader of war with eagerness conducts the battle. A mighty country loves mighty reapers. Blood is a heavy return for new mead. I love that line. It's so
really good.
His cheeks are covered with armor all around. There is a trampling of accoutrements. Accoutrements are trampled. He calls for death and brings desolation. In the first onset, his lances penetrate the targets, and for light on the course, shrubs blaze on the spears. So I think the Gododdin is such an interesting text because it is really of a type that we can recognize it. I mean, actually, I'll throw this to you, Olivia. Can you think of any other stories about 300 mighty warriors facing down a vastly superior army and dying to the man, but dying gloriously?
Wait, I can do this.
Emphasis on the word 300.
I can do this. Wait.
Because the audience are screaming at you right now.
Wait, no. I've got it. Sparta.
I mean, 300. But yeah, like, it's the story of Thermopylae.
Okay, yeah, it didn't happen in Sparta. But no. They came from Sparta.
Yeah, so the story of Leonidas and the 300 Spartans is very much of that archetype. But there's another, but it's, and I think that's part of a general canon of heroic failure. I mean, to take another example, think about the fate of Constantine the 11th.
Yeah.
Friend of the show. Like, there is something, I think, something endlessly compelling about dying gloriously. And I think when we're trying to understand why this is such a canonical text in Welsh bardic tradition, I think we really need to understand the experience of the Welsh Middle Ages as the long defeat.
Yeah, because basically what you described in that poem, that was just Wales over and over again. Yes. In the Middle Ages.
Of glorious defeat emphasis, but the emphasis on the poem is on glory, if you think about it. Like, and I've got some examples. Like, there's so many descriptions of color, for example. Like, we have descriptions of dark blue armor and swan-white steeds and bright blue swords and white, icy-hued and chalked shields. It's this incredibly vivid picture that's probably more artistic representation than what people were actually wearing. But what I think it says is, you know, the doomed warriors heading out to defend their kingdom one final time, is a way of sort of, it does two things. First of all, it says, yes, we were defeated, but we were glorious when we did it. But also, I think that that idea is, and I'm going to crib heavily from the Irish writer Fintan O'Toole, who's written pretty heavily about the motif of heroic failure in culture. What is appealing about the doomed charge and the last stand in culture is it's something that we can never actually achieve. It provides a catharsis to people who are living under oppression. And make no mistake, Welsh people were living in very, very difficult circumstances. They were systematically oppressed in England, and under English rule, and I don't use those terms at all lightly.
No, absolutely. I think it's, you know, as much as arguably Scotland as well was mistreated by the English, I think that
this was way worse for much longer.
I think that the relationship between Scotland and England often gets described as like a settler colonialist one, which
it's
wasn't.
Just not.
It was more like a really messy, really incestuous situationship.
Yes, exactly. It's a toxic situationship.
Yeah, exactly. You know, between two countries that like have their own monarchs and like, you know, intermittently and have, you know, sovereignty. Intermittently to varying degrees, whereas in Wales, what you saw over the course of the Middle Ages and fully completed by the end of the Middle Ages, it was settler colonialism.
They were
displacing Welsh people. They were taking out the Welsh nobles, putting in English, i.e. Norman ones, and establishing new towns for them to move in, people of a different cultural, ethnic, you know, linguistic group, specifically with the intention of displacing and disenfranchising Welsh people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
For centuries.
And so when you are living on your knees and you have no choice to, because, you know, let's be honest, if you are living in an oppressive regime, whatever that looks like, you still have to live and you still have family. And so rebelling against it is an incredibly dangerous thing to do. And it, for most people, it does just make more sense to put up with it. But if you do, it is so, so tempting to fantasize about going out historic one last time, because that's the thing you can never do.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about the Gododdin, and one of the things that I think would have been interesting about it to experience it as a performance, is that it is written in the first person. It is written from the perspective of somebody who was at the battle and escaped, as I referenced in the section that I read. And so when you would have seen the performance, it would have felt like the spirit of this dead poet is possessing the person in front of you. And it creates this link, this temporal link between a person 400 years ago and you now. So Benedict Anderson, in his sort of seminal book about the origins and spread of nationalism, called Imagined Communities, his argument is that nationalism is a modern phenomenon that that arises as a form of seeking secular immortality, that you can live forever if you subsume yourself within this imagined community of the nation. And I think that what the structure of the Gododdin does is subliminally connects you to the, like the water of life. That's right. This was a setup all along from Dune. It connects you to the memories of your ancestors, and it subsumes you into this eternal story that is forever in the present tense.
Wow. Sometimes this podcast is like a sandworm swallowing its own tail.
One of the things that I think is interesting, or one of the, I think, unexpected consequences of the English subjugation of Wales is that praise poetry starts to not die off, but certainly decline as a poetic form, because quite frankly, there aren't as many patrons to pay for it. Like, if you're some Anglo-Norman lord and some Welsh guy comes up to you and says, can I perform some poetry for you in Welsh? And then you pay me for it. He's like, what?
Yeah, literally.
No.
Go suck rocks, man.
I don't care about, or I don't give a shit about any of that.
And what the fuck is a Cymru?
And so I think that with the decline of sort of Welsh, with the extinction of Welsh independence from the sort of 13th century onwards, I think you see new forms and focuses for poetry and poetic expression start to really take the fore.
Yes, so you do have a branching off and a flowering of different types of poetry, in particular nature poetry, which on one hand, I would argue in the English tradition is one of the most bland and unimpressive forms of poetry, not because it's inherently bad, but seems not to be a genre that invites new innovation.
We figured it all out in the 19th century, and then basically it's been just variations on that.
Yeah, exactly. Except E. Cummings. He was cool. However, that being said, medieval Wales, completely different story. We have been talking about Dafydd Ap Gwilym a lot. That's not going to end anytime soon.
He's our boy.
I think he's generally agreed to be one of the best Welsh poets ever, if yeah. not the best. If oh, yeah. not one of the best British poets ever, if not the best. So Dafydd was born in the 14th century. He died quite young as well, by the way. I think
only 30, I think.
Yeah, he's assumed to have died of the Black Plague around 30. And he was born into a pretty noble family by all accounts. So this was not a guy who had to hit the ground running in general. He, you know, probably did not necessarily have to write poetry to pay the bills or put food on the table. And that's actually wonderful.
He was a Nepo baby.
He was a Nepo baby. He was the best kind of Nepo baby because he was incredibly talented and he gave us all sorts of wonderful pieces about nature, some of which are about wonderful things like May flowers in the morning sun, and some of which are very kind of like personal poems about beef that he has with different animals.
I've written a few of those poems myself.
Yeah, definitely. So he wrote one about... He wrote one, yeah, it is funny, like, flipping through his book, because it's like, in praise of summer, and then the next one will be like, I hate owls. So here's a poem by Dafydd about an owl. In particular, it's titled, The Owl Disturbs the Bard's Sleep. I won't read the whole thing, but it goes, it starts, Wretched owlet, worthless bird. Always are her accents heard. She must ever wail and cry while the stars are in the sky. I can never rest or sleep for the noise she loves to keep. With the bat, she lives together in the rainy, snowy weather. Every day, my ear she tears with her shrieks and hideous airs. Every night, all slumber flies at her wild salute, my eyes. I am vexed the long night through with her vile to-who. it's just great. And he goes on. It's
he
quite
fucking
a long...
hates owls.
I know. It's unfortunate because I think owls are really cool.
Do we have anything sort of stupendously beautiful that we can read?
Well, he's got one.
Does he like any animals?
He's got a really good one about hanging out with a fox.
Okay, I'll hear that.
Okay, so and here's another one about a fox, and here especially we can see Dafydd weave in a little bit of, you know, human story and a little bit of autobiographical content as he was wont to do. So this one is about a fox. The fox. Yesterday was I, sure of purpose, under the trees, alas that the girl doesn't see it, standing under Ovid's stems and waiting for a pretty girl beneath the trees. She made me weep on her way. I saw when I looked there, an ape's shape where I did not love, a red fox sitting like a tame animal, on his haunches near his den. I drew between my hands a bow of yew there. It was brave, about like an armed man. On the brow of the hill, a stirring of high spirits, weapon for coursing along a district to hit him with a long, stout bolt. I drew for a try a shaft, clear past the jaw. My grief, my bow went in three pieces, luckless disaster. I got mad. I did not dread him, unhappy bear, at the fox. He's a lad who'd love a hen, a silly bird and bird flesh. He doesn't follow the cry of horns, rough his voice and his carol. Ruddy is he in front of a talus slope, like an ape among green trees. At both ends of a field there turns up a dog shape, looking for a goose. Crow's beacon near the brink of a hill, acre strider, color of an ember, likeness of a lure for crows and magpies at a fair, portent looking like a dragon. Lord of excitement, chewer of a fat hen, of acclaimed fleece, glowing flesh, and all of hollowed out fine earth, fire dish at the edge of a shuttered window, copper bow of light feet, tongs like a beak of blood. Not easy for me to follow him and his dwelling toward Annan. Red roamer, he was found to be too fierce. He'd run ahead of a course of hounds. Sharp his rushing, gorse strider, leopard with a dart in his rump.
So that was beautiful. So to summarize, he's waiting for a hot babe, and then he sees a fox that's so cool that he forgets all about the hot babe.
That's about it.
It's the most relatable thing I've ever read. Okay, so now to the bit I've been waiting to get to for the entire show.
We've slowly been circling the drain, haven't we?
Which is that not all the love poetry of medieval Wales was this beautiful sort of airy bucolic scene with like foxes and stuff. Some of it was profoundly sexual and horny.
And I should mention as well that being able to read these poems in English is a relatively recent thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Because up until a certain time in the 20th century, people just would not translate these poems because they would read them and they were a lot of them were so crude and profane. They would just close the book and say, you know what, this isn't making it into the anthology.
Can you imagine some poor Victorian archivist opening up a page that says an ode to the penis and then quickly shutting it? Yeah, that's right. This is what we're talking about now.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've introduced one of the most notorious poems of the Welsh Middle Ages, which is another work by, you guessed it, Dafydd Ap Gwilym.
God love the man. He had range.
He had unbelievable range. He could just pivot from, you know.
I love this. Is a beautiful nature scene. I hate this animal. And let's talk about penis.
My friend's a gimp. So this is a poem, first of all, as we've discussed with Welsh poems before, it's written in a very specific meter, I think you would call it Cywydd meter? Don't know exactly. And it's essentially, formal structure for poems and rhyming couplets. So again, as I mentioned before, he's taking an established structure and using it in a kind of funny way. And according to the paper that I read, there are 11 copies of this poem. So
that's 10 too many. It's rough. This one's going to be, I feel really uncomfortable. I'm going to have to do a silly voice when I read it just to like get into the headspace.
I can read it if you want.
No, it's fine. Cause there's one for you that I'm definitely not doing.
No spoilers.
Yeah. No spoilers, but this poem has a sequel. So, the poem of the penis goes, "May God give a penis, need there is to watch over thee with an eye hereafter. For this, from the claim of the stiff-necked stake, otherwise forevermore, wing of the body, need there is, lest complaint, to put a bridle to thy face, to restrain thee, so that thou not be charged. Once more, bright work of our minstrels, most hateful roll of wood, thou art with me. Horn of a cod, neither rises nor will I get a New Year's gift from good women of the faith. The claim of a lap, swelling, a fit of misfortune. Cease thy strange whim, accursed stick. The two halves of a maiden, eel of the thin hole, more like a green hazel stick thou art than the thigh of a large man. Arrayed with night, a long chisel, a staff thou art for word of great love, clasp of the cover of the bare bottom of a girl. Sorry, I'm just, for those at home, we're almost done, but I am just looking at Olivia occasionally.
I'm trying to avoid eye contact varying degrees of success.
The eye of your head watches every pretty little wife happily, wise and stupid, the testicles of thy tribe, skin of dewlap, muzzles, two testes of fruit, a theft thou art of wantonness, shape of the neck bone of a goose. Oh, man. Oh, fucking hell. I feel like I was just possessed by the spirit of a 14-year-old boy.
It's great. I mean, we don't have a lot of surviving examples of Welsh erotic poetry, but we probably have more than any other insular erotic poetry traditions that I'm aware of. So,
congratulations on vastly, vastly, like, sort of restoring the decorum of this podcast by talking about insular poetic traditions.
I'm just saying, I mean, you don't, you know, necessarily get a lot of stuff this blatant from, you know, contemporary English
poems. Here's 50 stanzas. Here's 7 stanzas about my penis. God, he's a real... You can tell he died young, huh?
Yeah.
Because I feel like a 60-year-old David probably would have tried to get this expunged.
Oh, gosh. We need an alternate history about David that didn't die of the plague. Man, rest in peace.
Oh, man. But you think you're out of the woods. But I assure you, you're not. Because we need to talk about... We talked plenty about David, but we need to talk about not one of his contemporaries, but somebody writing... 100 years later, because you may be wondering at home, oh, it's all well and good for all these men talking about their pricks again. If you ever had a woman talking like that about her vulva, she'd be stoned to death, right? Well.
Guess what?
Guess again. Because there was a lady in the 15th century by the name of Gwerthil Machain who wrote... Well, it's the name is translated lots of different ways.
Yeah, essentially it's the feminine counterpart to David's penis poem.
Let's call it the vulva.
Yeah, David's poem is a very masculine one, I would say. It's not, I would say, an unknown characterization of the male genitalia, in that he's kind of describing it as this, like, separate entity that has a mind of its own, and it's very much about male sexuality in a joking, you know, goofy way. He's describing, you know, this embodiment of his impulses. And, well, that's all well and good. And, you know, more or less par for the course when it comes to medieval erotic poetry. But let's also talk about a woman who wrote a poem that's arguably a response to this from a slightly less, you know, I don't want to say patriarchal, but from a slightly less...
It's the opposite kind of horny.
From a slightly more feminine perspective.
Stop with the euphemisms. Just say what it is.
Well, she wrote a poem about her vagina, but she wrote it for a specific reason that was different to the reason why David wrote his, which is...
Keep telling yourself that.
Skirting around the subject matter. I'm just trying to give her, you know, due recognition.
I mean, she does write poetry, other poetry, that is just graphic descriptions of female sexuality. So
it's very erotic.
She wrote a poem called Jealous Wives, which is all about how more women should let her sleep with their husbands. And she says, I ought to know. There's no man, well hung or not, who's not mine for the taking. Silly girls, you'll not give for any gold your husband's pricks. Though you can't prevent them from chasing, and there's a word here that I'm choosing not to translate. You'll clench it in your cold hand, that cock, and not lose your hold for anything. And you'll squeal, adultery? There's no deal. Why won't these women let me fuck their husbands?
Yeah, but you know, it's even though it's very sexual in a way that absolutely is both horny and transgressive, it's also, she's, you know, she's making fun of these women, not specifically just because they don't want her to sleep with their husbands, but also, you know, at their jealousy and at their, you know, kind of futility and controlling tendencies. Because she also wrote about domestic violence, for instance. So she wrote a poem called "To Her Husband Beating Her." Here's a bit of it. That's right, I'm bringing the mood down.
Yay.
"To her husband beating her, a dagger through your heart stone, on a slant to reach your breastbone. May your knees break, your hands shrivel, and your sword plunge in your guts to make you snivel."
Get his ass.
Yeah. And a lot of these poems that she's writing are responses to poems written by male contemporaries. So we've talked, of course, on this podcast about Christine de Pizan, my fave.
Yes, your spiritual queen.
The center of my world.
The woman who you have a parasocial relationship with, despite there being 600 years of distance between the two of you.
Exactly. But in the same way that Christine was, you know, spent a lot of her work defending women against stereotypes from men, I would argue that Guerfel McCain, how do you pronounce it?
I don't know.
I would
argue, I'm only a quarter Welsh.
I would argue that, how do you pronounce a quarter of it then? I would argue that Guerfel's poems, you know, in the same way, are hitting out at what, until, you know, her life was a pretty male-dominated tradition after her life as well. So anyways, bearing that in mind, here's a poem she wrote called "To the Vagina." "Every foolish, drunken poet, boorish vanity, without ceasing, never may I warrant it, I of great noble stock, has always declaimed fruitless praise in the song of the girls of the lands, all day long, certain gift, most incompletely, by God the Father, praising the hair, gown of fine love, and every such living girl, and lower down, praising merrily, the brows above the eyes, praising also, lovely shape, the smoothness of the soft breasts, and the beauty's arms, bright drape, she deserved honor, and the girl's hands. Then, with his finest wizardry, before night he did sing, he pays homage to God's greatness, fruitless eulogy with his tongue, leaving the middle without praise, and the place where children are conceived, and the warm quim, clear excellence, tender and fat, bright, fervent, broken circle, where I loved, in perfect health, the quim below the smock. You are a body of boundless strength, a faultless court of fat's plumage. I declare the quim is fair, circle of broad-edged lips. It is a valley longer than a spoon or a hand, a ditch to hold a penis two hands long. Cunt there by the swelling arse, song's table with its double in red, and the bright saints, men of the church, when they get the chance, perfect gift, don't fail, highest blessing, by Buno, to give it a good feel. For this reason, thorough rebuke, all you proud poets. Let songs to the quim circulate without fail to gain reward. Sultan of an ode, it is silk, little seam, curtain on a fine bright cunt, flaps in a place of greeting. The sour grove, it is full of love. Very proud forest, faultless gift, tender frieze, fur of a fine pair of testicles. A girl's thick grove, circle of precious greeting. Lovely bush, God save it."
I mean, she's pretty clearly like calling, you're, as you say, she's calling out David and all those like him. And so I just want to say that I think it's wonderful to imagine two dueling horny Welsh poets.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, but this is what I mean when I say that it's not just, you know, a horny poem.
It's, oh, I know, also, it's not just, you know, horny. There's other stuff going on. It has themes.
Oh, yes.
It's a work of literature.
In her poem about the vagina,
I remember it.
Guerfel writes about the hypocrisy of male poets, that they would praise all of the parts of a woman's body, but notably she says that they leave the middle without praise.
What could that possibly be referring to?
The vagina.
Really?
Yes. However, I think that if we expand the metaphor and take all of insular poetic tradition to be a woman's body. And home in on one part of it that's been widely ignored. If we get deep in there.
We've been really rooting around.
And in explore.
In the middle of insular Celtic poetry.
Yes. Then I think, as Querville suggests, we might uncover things that, you know, are far, far more deserving of praise than the mainstream might lead us to believe. In her case, it's the vagina. In our case, it's medieval Wales.
I think the underappreciated is right. I don't think it's a coincidence that Welsh poetry is underappreciated, to be sincere for a second. I think that it's the cultural expression of a people who were marginalized for an incredibly long time. Their language was, in many cases, you know, literally beaten out of them. You know, the Welsh language is going through a revival these days, but for a long time it was a sign of very, very low class among the Anglo-Norman elite, and especially, you know, when the entire territory of Wales came under English dominion. So the fact that it has been preserved is incredible, and I think that it speaks to the fact that Wales and Welshness have persevered in the absence of a state is incredibly, incredibly interesting. Like, countries reproduce themselves through their institutions. So the fact that Wales, in many cases, lacked national institutions makes its the endurance of a body of Welsh literature a remarkable achievement that says we are a proud people with culture to offer the world. And as they say in Wales, Amarohid.
We are still here.
We are still here.
Yeah, despite the fact that, you know, don't want to read too much into etymology, but, you know, the fact that to me, the word for Wales and the word for, you know, as a country and the word for the Welsh people are pronounced the same, I think that's quite poetic because it was the people of Wales, even in absence of sovereignty, who kept their culture and their traditions alive, and not only alive, but flourishing into something really beautiful and unique that's still absolutely incredible.
So, well, that's just about going to do us for another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. If you've made it this far, thank you, I'd say, for taking a chance on something that you probably didn't know about before. Because it is a really interesting topic, I think. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was educational. Thank you to Aaron, who, like all Americans, will proudly tout his insular heritage at any opportunity. And as a one-quarter Welshman insisted that we do this episode, he didn't have to insist much because as an existing fan of Dafydd and Gwerfel, I was more than happy to oblige.
What can I say? I had too many Krabby's ginger beers one night and I decided that I was Omab Daragan. That's the son of prophecy. But yeah, no. If you enjoyed this, then please do give us a 5-star review and tell your friends about this show. It's the only way we get new listeners because we don't advertise. And also, if you enjoyed it, tell us what you think by leaving a review or a comment on Spotify. One person left a very nice comment in response to our most recent episode about weird medieval animal facts. They said, really fun and charming episode. I was even thinking about re-listening to it with my kids until I got to the part about bears. I'm sorry about that. We should do a family-friendly edition one day.
When I was a child in primary school or elementary school, as they call it there in Montana, my mom taught as an adjunct professor at Montana State University. She taught a course that was beautifully titled, it was called something like Using Your Imagination, and they would do, it was beautiful, and they did like a 1 week unit every semester about like childhood, where they would read The Little Prince, and she would bring me and my brothers to the seminar with the college kids.
That's
and
like so cute.
Ask us what we thought about the books, so.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It was beautiful.
That's a nice thing to end on.
So maybe we should bring in some children.
This recording setup would not work for that. I'm just going to be real with you.
Yeah, you're right. But anyways.
We can bring our childlike spirits.
Yes, definitely.
We always do.
Here's how I'm nurturing my inner child. Oh, God. I hate those.
Well, where can people find you?
You can find me, as ever, on Twitter at Weird Medieval Guys, or my personal account at Olivia _MS.
And you can find me at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter and at Aaron on Blue Sky. Got in very early with that.
And until next time, Hwylfawr. No, wait.
That means goodbye.
Okay.
Take it easy.
That's Welsh for hang tight. A travel was gonna come here, a travel call on none of them.